The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
This episode of Writing Excuses is brought to you by Audible. Visit audiblepodcast.com/excuse to start your free trial membership.
Season 9, Episode 51.
This is Writing Excuses Q&A at the Writing Retreat.
15 minutes long.
Because you're in a hurry.
And we want to go eat.
I'm Brandon.
I'm Dan.
I'm Mary.
And I'm keeping us from dinner by talking long-winded.
No, it'll still only be 15 minutes. It'll just be them having to listen to. Anyway, questions. First question is from Gamma.
So in the trend of moral ambiguity, is there still a place for a story with a villain who is unquestionably evil and with the moral absolute there?
Wow, that's a good question. What he's bringing up is that, particularly in fantasy recently, the trend has been for shades of gray, kind of kicked off by George R. R. Martin coming to prominence. I would say I believe that there is. I believe that anything done well will be captivating. Harry Potter had an unquestionably evil villain who was really evil and interestingly evil, and it worked.
Yeah, and I can think of someone in real life that I would think of as unquestionably evil without naming any names, so I have no problems believing it in
I'm
fiction.
I'm right here, Mary.
You know what? In playing the Borderlands 2 game,
Handsome Jack. So
he
evil.
He talks about himself like he's the hero of the story, but there's no doubt that it's, yeah.
And there's no doubt that he really kind of knows evil he is.
And I would point as well to, you know, something that is much more ambiguous than those, like Abercrombie's First Law series, in which the heroes are all various shades of dark gray, but the bad guys are pretty much just as evil as possible.
So, yes. Next
Plenty
question.
Okay, if you have a chance to publish a first book and it isn't representative of what you actually want to be writing, should you publish it?
Well, you've written it, and are they offering you money?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, I would still publish it. The worst case scenario of that is that you publish your second book under a different name. If someone is paying you, then... Yes, I do want to add the little caveat on this one, though. I'm glad I didn't publish my early books. But those who did publish their early books and they took off, I can think of several of them that are millionaires, like super big millionaires, and I don't think they mind too much. So the worst case is that you have to publish under a new name, and you probably won't have to do that. If someone wants to publish your book and give you money, yes should probably be the default, depending on the contract.
I would say yes. Okay, qualify it just a little bit. You wrote this because it was something you wanted to write, but it's not what you want to be known for. But maybe what you want to be known for is, I can write more than one thing.
Yeah.
Oh, look, I got a paycheck for this, and now I'm going to write something different and get a paycheck for that. And
yeah, Ted Williams has a really good career writing a different type of genre every single novel.
Is it possible to write an epic fantasy novel with only one POV?
It's called Name of the Wind.
Yes.
And it is hearty stew for the...
yes, it is. But you'll note that you still wind up with a giant cast.
Yes.
So that the epicness of it... And you could make the argument that there are two POVs.
Yes, you could. There are a couple of POVs, really, with the frame story. Mm-hmm. But Assassin's Apprentice, which we mentioned last week, is epic fantasy. Fate of the world is at stake. Large cast of characters, various interesting magics, high fantasy, and it is one POV through 9 books.
And the thing is that you're building it differently.
Yes.
You can't do it the same way as a multi-POV book, but you can do it.
You're going to have a really engaging voice for that character, would be my suggestion to you on that one. That's going to make it sink or swim.
Of all of the myriad talents of the literary agents you work with, what was the one thing that made you decide to stick with them?
Ooh, that's a good question.
She really likes my work. I mean, that sounds silly, but that is the core of our relationship, that I know, you know, that she is as invested in my career as I am. And so as important as it is that she has great international contacts and that she knows how the taxes work and all these other really good things that she does, she is as invested in my career as I am because she loves my work.
Yeah, that was for me with Jen as well, and that she was looking at the long-term arc of my career rather than just this book.
Mm-hmm. Couple things about Joshua that really made me early on say, yes, I want to be with this person. First off, he gave a critique of my novel that Tor was offering to buy, where he identified the major structural flaw with the book that when I changed, improved the book dramatically. He did a better job on that than most editors I've worked with. Secondly, he makes money for me, meaning Joshua costs a lot. He costs 15% of what I make, and we're doing pretty well. So he makes me more than he costs me. That's a really good sign. I still feel that he makes me more than he costs me. Even if you only look at the foreign sales, which I would not really be able to accomplish on my own, that recoups what he has cost me and then some by taking 50% of my U.S. And so there is that. And the last thing that really made me stuck with Joshua was when I had my first book and really was a nobody. I mean, my first the offer was for $5,000 on my first book, which is, you know, run-of-the-mill early advance. But it is, I mean, that means he's making, what, $700 off of all that work that he did, which is way less than an attorney would get for the same amount of time. He gave me, like, he didn't just give me the time of day. We had weekly phone calls. I felt like I was being treated like a superstar from day one with Joshua.
I was wondering, when you're in the middle of outlining and researching for a novel or series, how do you, and you have limited time, how do you make sure that your writing skills don't atrophy, meaning that you only have a certain amount of time in the day and you're using it to research and outline? Do you keep a blog? Do you just do writing exercises?
This is a good question that I think is more applicable when you have to balance a regular job. So I want to really hear what Dan says about this one because...
Well, you mentioned blogs. I, for years and years and years, ran a game review website and did weekly editorials on that. I did game reviews. I did strategy articles. I was writing constantly, even though not as much of it was prose. Today, I don't do as much of that. In fact, I barely ever update my blog. What I have started finding myself doing now is, that was a really awkward sentence, wasn't it? Working on short fiction. You know, while I am researching the new book that I'm doing or the new multi-book series that I'm doing, I don't want the writing to slack off, and so I'm going to write a short piece about whatever.
Yeah, and I'm going to give a slightly different answer, which is that I don't mind not writing for a while, but what I look at is ways to gear up again into writing mode when I am transitioning from, novel or outlining or puppet building back into that. And one of the things that I do is that I will go on long walks or do some other physical activity in which I plan out the scene and think about it in my head. And then I will go ahead and write it. I will also give myself time to free write where I'm not worrying about plot, but I'm just like, oh yeah, let me actually remember how to put string words together in a sentence. And so those are some things that I will do when I'm doing a transition period.
See, I've never worried about this because if I take time off to outline or plot, it's never more than a couple of months. Even when I was a new writer, I was working the graveyard shift. I was working on my writing 5 to 6 hours a day. And so if you're working that much on your story, I mean, I could see writing skill atrophying if it's like you're going to have to take 2 years doing this because you can only write a half hour a day, which is why I pointed down. But it's never even something I've even considered.
Well, I should point out, I'm not concerned that my writing skills are going to disappear so much that if I don't write, I know I'm going to get grumpy.
Yeah, and that's what happens to me, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Howard?
You guys are fine.
Okay.
What are some issues and concerns to be aware of when a short story writer begins writing a novel?
Ha! That could be an entire podcast.
Yes, it could. Let's do a quick answer, and then we'll think about doing a full podcast on it.
So when you transition from short to long form, the things that I find are different are the amount of description, and one of the things we were also talking about in the previous podcast, the enfranchised versus disenfranchised reader. A novel reader and a short story reader come in with different expectations about the amount of exposition they're going to get. And this is one of the big areas that I see people failing to transition when they're going from short to long form. Short story readers are used to having to fill in the gaps because there's not enough space. Novel readers are used to there being enough space for everything. So they assume that if the author does not put it in, it has been forgotten and missed and it's an accident. And so you actually wind up having to put more exposition in, that you have to make sure more of the details and fill out the picture more. I shouldn't say exposition, but you have to fill out the picture more. Then there's also the number of characters and plot arcs that you're looking at. A lot of times, short stories, you really only have space to do one or two plot arcs. And novels, depending on the genre that you're going on into, they're expecting to see multiples. And so sometimes it can be too simple.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. If we cover this more, I'd like to have Eric James Stone on the podcast because he recently sold a book to Bain. And that book was he was primarily a short story writer, and he had all of these issues, every one of them you just mentioned, and had to work through them in creating his novel.
Hey, writers, are you thinking about learning a new language? I think exploring the world, experiencing other cultures, and being able to communicate with people outside your everyday experience lets you create richer, better stories. A great way to do that is with Rosetta Stone, a trusted expert for over 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. They use an immersive technique which leads to fast language acquisition. It's an intuitive process that helps you really learn to speak, listen, and most of all, think in the language you're trying to learn. They also feature true accent speech recognition technology that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a voice coach in your home. Learn at home or on the go with a desktop and mobile app that let you download and access lessons even when you're offline. And it's an amazing value. A lifetime membership gives you access to all 25 languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, Japanese, and, of course, Korean. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Writing Excuses listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, let's do our book of the week. Sarah Glassman is going to pitch a book to us.
I would like to recommend Angel Maker by Nick Harkaway. It is incredibly read by Daniel Wyman on Audible. Joe Spork is a hapless London clockmaker who happens to be the son of a London-style gangster. His life is turned upside down when he meets the octogenarian super spy Edie Bannister, who releases a 1950s-style doomsday device.
Wow.
I want to read that book now. Yeah.
Your pitch is way better than our pitches, even on our own books.
She's a bookseller professional.
Oh,
she's
okay.
Cheating.
Yeah. Okay. See, we decided for this Q&A, and if we do future of these, we wanted to have one of the students pitch a book because, you know, we have done it a lot. And
we're just
going
to have Sarah.
Showed us up.
We're just going to have Sarah
pitch
all of the books.
How can they get this book?
Audiblepodcast.com/excuse. Start a 30-day free trial membership with Audible. And get, I have now, all I remember is
Angel
Edie
Maker.
Bannister, Angel Maker, free.
Great. That is a wonderful pitch. I want to go listen to that book now.
Yeah, me too.
All right. So, next question.
All right. This is kind of targeted at Brandon, but I'd like to hear everyone's answer if possible. Brandon, at times you've mentioned free writing your characters that you need to scrap them, and then other times you talked about adjusting and tweaking them, and if you have tips on when you decide which way is the way to go.
Yes, yeah, so what he is referencing is that I discovery write my characters more and more these days. It's the way that I come up with characters who are engaging and interesting and don't let the plot just kind of take over as much as I worry it can when I outline as much as I do. And because it is the thing I discovery write, it is the hardest thing for me to talk about and to give tips on because it's very instinctive. I look at what this character is doing. I say, am I interested? Am I excited to write more about this character? Can I see myself writing a variety of different scenes with this character that are all engaging and interesting? Does this character writing this viewpoint challenge me? I often look at that these days. Does it force me to stretch in my knowledge, in my ability to write somebody very different from myself? Does it give me lots of great moments where in this scene I say, that is that character, that line encapsulates that character? And if I'm getting some of those moments, but not enough, that's a revision. That's a tweak. That's a, okay, I kind of have something here. There's something exciting about this, and I'm getting it, but they're not coming together yet. If I'm not getting enough of them, if I'm not excited about the character, often it's because the character feels too much like someone I've done before or someone I've read before. That's when I toss the character and start over.
I've got a folder full of, the folder is called Off Track, and it is full of Schlock Mercenary scripts that I was writing as the next point in the story, and usually what is happening in those is somebody else has walked on screen, and I find myself exploring that character's voice, and by the end of the script, I just cannot make that character work with this script, but I don't want to throw it away, and so I chuck it in a folder and write something else, and I've ducked back into that folder and found that in many cases, what's in there is backstory for completely different characters who developed those voices. But yeah, it's the same sort of thing. I'm discovery writing my way into somebody's voice, and if I don't like it, I allow myself to not use it, but I still keep it because throwing things away is bad.
Yeah.
If you are putting together a character, you're designing your characters for your story, and you realize that one is not working, you can look at it and just ask yourself, is it more work to fix this or is it easier to tear it down and start over? You know, which one is going to be easier for you to do?
Yeah, we're exposing our inherent laziness, Dan.
Yeah, I think of it in terms of my theater background again, which is that I think of it as recasting the character. Sometimes I'll be partway in, or in the case of a more recent thing, I will have the entire book finished and realize that the character, that I essentially have the wrong actor playing the character. All of the plot spots are correct, but the inner life of the character is completely wrong. And so I will do a rewrite where I will replace the character with different motivation. And for me, it is thinking about the motivation of the character, what it is they want, and also what their background is. So, because their background and their history informs how they react to things. And a lot of times those are the places that I've gone wrong because the reactions do not jibe with what I need to be happening. So I give them a different backstory.
All right, we're going to let it go. One more question because you've been waiting so patiently.
When you build a story, do you find it easier to put the foreshadowing elements in as plot points or back on the first editing pass?
I'd say both. I do about half and half.
Yeah, both. Yeah.
Part of the reason that works for me is because of how I outline things. So I know that I'm building towards, you know, these few specific moments, and so as I'm writing, an opportunity will arise to go, oh, this is great. And I can't give you the example that just popped into my head because it's for the book that's not published yet. Sorry. But then about the other half of the time, you get to the end and you realize, oh, well, there's not enough yet. I need to go back and add more.
Yeah, and sometimes things that look like foreshadowing are really us looking back at the beginning and going, what can I use that I've already planted?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the running gag is a very common sort of structure. And far better than the running gag is the joke at the end of the story that absolutely wouldn't have worked if you hadn't told three or four jokes that led up to it. It's the same exact principle as the foreshadowing. About half the time, I know what the final joke is, and I will write the jokes that lead up to it. And the other half of the time, I am writing jokes, and I have no idea what the last joke is.
Or what you're going to say.
Well, after I've told the first three, there's hand signals flying across the room that our listeners have no idea are flying across the room. I will have told three or four jokes, and then the last one comes to me, and I realize, oh, well, maybe my subconscious was foreshadowing that one. And that's where I get to end up.
All right. I want to ask a student to give us a writing prompt.
Oh, you didn't warn them.
Burn. I know I didn't. Has anybody got a writing prompt for us?
The favorite one I have is everywhere Edward looked, everything was covered with ketchup.
That's your first line.
Nice.
You're out of excuses. Now go write.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.